Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, finding a cure for dengue fever and how you can help.
Dengue is a virus that spread from human to human through the mosquito. There is a dengue virus that has been made by all the exact same quality standards that you would for a vaccine.
Plus, we'll examine some common foot and ankle problems.
Because we do walk on our feet so much and use them so much every day, it's very, very common to have a foot and ankle issue.
And hot flashes and heart problems in women.
Studies have been done on estrogen alone. Estrogen was found to lower the total cholesterol, to lower the LDL, to increase the HDL, and these are all protective.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore the most common orthopedic foot problems and how to treat them. Plus, we discover the connection between hot flashes, hormones, and heart disease. But first, the search for a vaccine to fight dengue fever and how you can help. With all the uproar about Ebola, we've become more and more sensitive to the global nature of infectious diseases. No longer are we immune to diseases that begin halfway around the world. Dengue fever is one such disease. It's a viral infection usually found in the tropics that affects more than 50 million people worldwide each year, and it's returned to the continental U.S. And to date, there is no cure. Joining us with more on this is Dr. Mark Polemis, Director of the Center for Global Health and Translational Science at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Polemis. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So first, help us understand, what exactly is this disease, dengue fever? I know it's also called breakbone fever. Tell us about it.
It is breakbone fever. So dengue is a virus that spread from human to human through the mosquito. It's in the same family as West Nile. It's historically thought of a disease that's outside the United States, but it's slowly been creeping its way back into the United States. It's a disease that doesn't have a lot of mortality with it, not a lot of death, but it causes sickness, which is usually characterized as severe pain behind the eyes, headaches, very high fevers, and joints and muscles aching so badly that it got the name breakbone fever.
How serious is it, though? What's the prognosis for people who get it?
The vast majority of people who get the disease recover. It's an interesting disease because the first time you get it, about 50% of the people that get the disease don't have any symptoms. The other 50% get what's called breakbone fever. But the second time you get the disease, if you get a separate serotype.
So there's more than one strain of the disease. I think I recalled that.
There are four strains of the disease, and then they've labeled them nicely, dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Makes it easy.
The first time you get an infection, about 50% of the time, you're asymptomatic, you have no symptoms. The other 50% of the time, you have breakbone fever with the headaches and the fever and the eye pain and the joint pain and muscle pain, maybe a little bit of bleeding of the gums. The second time you get an infection, if you get one of the other serotypes of dengue, a small percentage of those can go on to severe dengue, which can be dengue hemorrhagic fever or bleeding.
So then it becomes much more serious.
Much more serious.
So is it if they get a different serotype or if they get the same serotype?
A different serotype. So if you're protected against the same serotype.
Because your body's already mounted an immune response to the first one. But if you should be infected with the second one, is it something to do with the fact that the body's immune response is much more virulent or more intense?
It's an immune response to the second infection that actually causes the complications of it. So it presents after you become afebrile, after your fever breaks, and after the virus goes away in the blood. That's when you get severely sick in the second infection with malaria.
So basically, if you don't have, if it's you're not on the second one, generally prognosis is short-term illness, and you don't really, you may or may not know you've had it unless you've had this severe breakbone fever, is what you're saying. And there's not much they can do about it, isn't it? Just palliative, you know, giving Tylenol, keeping them symptomatically comfortable, that kind of thing?
That's correct. In the first infection, far less than 1% of the of patients go on to severe disease. So more, way more than 99% of the patients just have a disease that comes and goes, kind of like a very severe flu kind of symptoms. The second time you get the infection, though, even those folks in the right hands have a very, very low death rate. So in areas of the world where dengue is common, with fluid rehydration and care, it's not a disease of death. But there is no specific pill to treat it. It's through supportive care with control of the fevers and the fluid shifts and the bleeding.
So at this point, we really don't have a cure or a way to even prevent it.
That's correct.
You're basically, if you're in the environment, so let's get back to this. So it's transmitted via mosquito. It's not human to human.
Correct. It has to be a mosquito.
Mosquito yep. to human. Okay. And where do the mosquitoes get the disease?
From another human.
Okay, so the mosquito is the vector.
Correct.
And so it does go human to human, but via the mosquito.
Correct.
In a sense.
Human to mosquito to human.
Human to mosquito to human, wow. So, I mean, it's now in the United States, and it had been eliminated from the United States. Is that something, I mean, should we be worried about it?
We should be worried about it. So dengue fever is... it's an emerging infection. There are more infections now than there were 10 years ago.
Really?
So while the rest of the world is working at controlling malaria and HIV and tuberculosis and all of these other diseases where we start to see we've turned the corner, dengue is the opposite. It's giving more infections now.
Do we know why?
We do. It's multifactorial. The vector is in a lot of places. And so what we've seen is that it's probably that the virus is now catching up with the vectors. So it's the spread of people through humans, spread of people through air travel.
So it's the international global nature of our world that it's being disseminated. But why increase? Why is there, I mean, just because you're saying it's being moved to different areas, it has more of an opportunity to expand or grow.
Well, the multifactorial part is that there is no way to stop the disease in a person, right? You have to prevent the mosquito bite or eliminate the mosquito is the only way to reduce the disease.
Is that akin to malaria in a way?
I mean, there's some overlapping issues with all of the diseases of the developing world that are vector borne. From that. But it's probably closer to the story of West Nile. West Nile came to the United States on the East Coast and then has quickly covered the entire United States. So dengue is in the same family as West Nile and now has crept into the United States. And likely, unless we can change the outcome anywhere that there is the mosquito vector in the United States, dengue should be able to spread.
Haven't there been real efforts at one point, though? I mean, you and I are going to talk more about the medical end of it, but haven't there been more efforts of late to try to control those mosquito populations? I mean, the mosquito abatement, for want of a better term, in terms of standing water and all of that kind of thing.
There have been huge efforts in the United States as well as around the world, and getting people under mosquito nets at night has been a huge issue. This is primarily a day-biting mosquito, however, so it's...
That's problematic.
It's not as prone to help from mosquito nets, and insect repellents are not used widely throughout the developing world, whereas they are in the United States. The developing world does not have closed houses with screens on there and air-conditioned units. And the stripe through the middle of the around the equator, where you have this kind of tropical climate all year round, is where the vast majority of the dengue is. And then there may be a component of global warming as that tropical stripe widens to take in more portions of the North America, South America, etc., the mosquito may be able to move with it.
There are more welcoming places for the mosquito to live. So you're saying we should we be worried in Central New York then?
Interestingly, there was a confirmed case of dengue in Long Island.
Really?
About two
well, that's
years.
Pretty close.
That's pretty close. Luckily, we do not have the vector here in upstate New York area based on the Department of Public Health's mosquito screenings. So from that perspective, we're safer than some areas. But any place the vector is potential for the disease.
And if it's as close as Long Island, you never, as we said, I think the one thing that I'm so aware of these days is that it's only a plane ride away. It's no longer the kind of thing where if you're in one part of the world, you really can feel safe because people are traveling, as we saw with Ebola, and bringing things to our shores that we never would have dreamt have been here. So now you're very involved in a brand new trial for a vaccine or a way to evaluate new dengue vaccines. Tell us about your efforts.
So to date, there is no FDA-approved vaccine to prevent dengue. And Dr. Tim Endy, who's the director of the Infectious Disease Division, and I have been working on vaccines for years.
He's here at Upstate.
He's here at Upstate, and he's been working in dengue vaccines for years.
And I might add, he himself was infected with dengue. We had him visiting. We had him on the show once, and he talked about his own experience with dengue.
So he's a true talent in the field. And over the past couple of years, we've evaluated two of the promising dengue vaccines. And the development effort is very, very long. It takes decades and millions and millions of dollars.
Why does it take so long?
Well, one of the issues is that there is no animal model for dengue.
What does that mean?
So we cannot give dengue to an animal and have them both have the virus circulating in their blood and be symptomatic. We cannot give a human dengue infection to an animal.
So animals do not get dengue?
Not the human forms.
Not the human form
that we're trying to get the vaccine on.
So not we even have, mice, the classic mice.
No. So there's no way to test our vaccines. We don't have any way to know if the vaccine works until we get it into humans.
Wow.
And it's not just the only way to test efficacy is you give a vaccine to somebody and then you have them bitten by the mosquito that gives them dengue, and then if it works. If you've protected them, that's how you tell. But you can only do that in very large studies in areas of the world that have dengue. And so that takes years and years to get through the multiple small trials to ensure it's safe first and then move them into larger and larger trials out into the developing world.
Isn't there also the danger, though, of infecting people? I mean, is there a certain kind of medical, ethical issue in terms of or not necessarily medical legal, because obviously people will agree to do this, I would think, to participate. But, I mean, I know many, many, many years ago in the history of infectious diseases, many scientists infected themselves to find the answers to these things. But times are different now, so how do you manage that?
Well, many of the development efforts for diseases that we know well have used a human infection model. So, for instance, malaria has been developing vaccines and drugs. They've been testing them, their efficacy early on through the use of human infection models. They've been doing it for more than 20 years. The influenza vaccine that everyone has received has probably been developed through the use of an influenza model. And historically,
so this is not new.
This is not new. They're for diarrheal illnesses. It goes on and on and on. But there's never been one developed for dengue, and that's what we're trying to do now.
Tell us more about it, because I don't want to run out of time.
Okay, so there is a dengue virus that has been made by all the exact same quality standards that you would for a vaccine. And what we're working with the Department of Defense and the FDA and a number of partners around the United States is to see if we can use this this vaccine candidate, this live attenuated dengue virus, to test vaccines. So what we're doing initially is in very small groups of healthy adults, we'll inoculate them with this dengue virus and follow them their course. If they develop a mild form of dengue consistently across a couple of studies, then we probably be able to use this to test dengue vaccines in the future.
So you're basically creating a dengue virus to use as injecting it into people as a way of testing whether a vaccine will work.
That's the ultimate goal. But what it is there's a dengue virus that has been attenuated, meaning it's been weakened.
It's not as virulent, altered. Right.
So it's not as
harmful
as a regular dengue virus. And we know that dengue, in its own right, causes sickness, but more sickness than death. And so we'll take this attenuated virus and then evaluate it. Our goal is to be able to produce an uncomplicated dengue, a mild form of dengue that would be reproducible over multiple trials.
And then use that to test the efficacy of vaccines.
Correct.
So you need people for this trial?
Tell us about this trial.
Who are you looking for?
Healthy adults between 18 and 45 years of age.
Does it matter if male, female, gender?
Does not matter, male or female.
But they have to have no underlying medical issues.
No underlying medical conditions. And we'll be able to help them evaluate that. We'll have a history and take a physical, and we'll do lab work to help help characterize their health. And the study has an intense period of about 1 month where they're seen every other day at the clinical trial center and followed up by phone on alternate days. And then if they get sick, we have a section of the community hospital where we'll be able to admit them and follow them and ensure that they're well.
So at this point, do you feel like there's any danger to the participants?
I think that in all clinical trials, there is a level of danger. We shouldn't kid ourselves about that. But this is been done before with dengue. This has been done before with other diseases. This virus is attenuated, and we have multiple safety measures in place to ensure that this goes well without complications.
So how do people get involved if they're interested in being this, you know, participant in this whole process?
Well, we have a number of ways we can be contacted. The SUNY Upstate webpage has a link to the Center for Global Health. You can email us at trials at upstate.edu, as in clinical trials, at upstate.edu. And we're on Facebook at the CGHATS, which is the Center for Global Health and Translational Science.
So great.
You can contact us.
And you're ready to go.
It's been through IRB approval, we're in discussions with the FDA, but we should be recruiting in the next month.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your work and your effort in this regard. It's very exciting. I mean, I think in general, we've made there's so much headway that's been made against infectious diseases in this world, and this is just another chapter in that. So I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing, and I wish you luck with the trials. My guest has been Dr. Mark Palemas. He's director of the Center for Global Health and Translational Science at Upstate Medical University. Next up, common orthopedic problems of the foot and ankle and what to do about them. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Our feet take us everywhere, and nothing can be more annoying and at times debilitating as problems with our feet or ankles. Here with some help is Dr. Scott Van Valkenburg. He's the Associate Professor of Orthopedic Surgery and the Division Chief of the Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So sometimes in our lives, you know, many of us, most of us have had some kind of injuries with our feet or our ankles or just problems with our feet and ankles. And you know, they often can be quite debilitating, but I think quite often we don't always know how to treat them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, and they're not always as straightforward as something as a fracture.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I want to get to a lot of those more kind of the soft tissue injuries and some of the less common ones. But let's talk specifically about fractures to start with.
Sure.
What are the kinds of fractures you see in people's feet and ankles?
Sure. Well, that's a very good question. You know, I would like to start out by saying, you know, the field of orthopedic foot and ankle surgery is, you know, it's because we do walk on our feet so much and use them so much every day. It's very, very common to have a foot and ankle issue. And so all these different pathologies or different conditions that we'll speak about today, you know, do come up fairly often. To get right to the point that you started making with fractures, fractures are one of the things that we do see quite often, and especially this time of year with in upstate New York, as you all know, with all the ice and snow, very common to sustain an injury to your ankle.
Slip and fall.
Exactly. So that is probably the most common way that we, the cause of an ankle fracture that we see on a daily basis.
How about sports injuries? Do you see a lot of those as well?
We do. Sports injuries tend to be more, probably because they happen in younger, healthier people, they tend to be more of the soft tissue ligamentous injuries that we'll get into later. Fractures can occur. You know, you'll be surprised at how little energy can go into an ankle fracture at some time. Sometimes even just what seems a very innocuous or something that you would think may just cause a sprain can actually lead to, you know, the bones around the ankle breaking.
And in those cases, just give me a very brief overview. When you have a fracture like that, what often happens in terms of treatment? What's necessary?
Sure. Well, you know, the first step would be to diagnose it. So, you know, that it does require, it's not something that can be diagnosed just from looking at it. Sometimes if it's dislocated or obvious, there's obvious deformity, then that's a little bit of a different situation. But, you know, a majority of these happen and the ankle looks swollen, but still seems to be in everything in the right spot. So something that would require an x-ray to diagnose. In terms of treatment, you know, we still tend to, you know, treat these if possible without surgery. There are, in the world of fractures, there's stable fractures and unstable fractures. Our science over years has taught us that, you know, ankles in particular need to be lined up, need to maintain their alignment well in order to ward off arthritis down the line.
So to heal properly.
In order to heal properly and avoid complications down the line. So we do have relatively low threshold, you know, if there is displacement to go in and do surgery to put the bones back in, you know, the anatomic alignment and to keep them there with plate and screws. Some of these fractures also can be treated simply in a cast with non-weight bearing. And some of them even, believe it or not, if they really do appear stable, can be treated in a walking boot.
A soft cast kind of thing, just a support
yes.
to allow the bones to refuse,
exactly.
That kind of thing. Often do you see that physical therapy is needed, or is that very much individual case-by-case basis?
It is individual case-by-case. You know, I don't think that in medicine in general, it's very rare that you can make blanket statements,
sure.
But I would say that, you know, I think therapy is, in the world of foot and ankle surgery, therapy is something that is often beneficial after the healing stage in order to really get people back to, you know, a normal gait pattern and also to regain some strength that is lost with any recovery from any of these conditions.
So with both, in order to regain both strength and flexibility, you might recommend that
exactly.
kind of thing, and in
yeah,
many
often
cases.
Often, ankle sprains, ankle fractures. Oftentimes, after the initial healing period, we do institute, it can also, one of the prime concepts behind foot and ankle therapy is to kind of to reconnect your foot or your ankle to your brain, to
remind the brain it's there.
Yeah, exactly. And to kind of retrain it and to kind of get your subconscious brain kind of reconnected with your foot.
Especially if you've been off it for a while,
exactly.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, the foot is made to, it's made to do its job. It's made to be used, and it doesn't like to not be used. And
so getting kind of a segue into something that is related is, I've often heard people talk about these things called stress fractures.
Sure.
That's a little different than the common fracture you've been talking about where there's an actual break in a bone.
Sure.
I guess it's a hairline break.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, what exactly is a stress fracture? Who gets them and how do they happen?
Well, the term stress fracture is not, believe it or not, it's not so much to do with the pattern of the fracture, more of the way that it's, what's the, primary cause.
Causation.
Of it. So a stress fracture is anytime, constantly our bones are going through a remodeling process that's what keeps them healthy. Your bones will turn over, every single living cell in your bone will turn over in over a period of about 7 years. So there's constantly, there's these cells that go in and, there's some cells that go in and take away some of the calcium and phosphate and the mineralization of the bone, and then there's other cells that go in and repopulate, redeposit these minerals. So anytime that the kind of the slight injury from just daily use outweighs that the bone's ability to replenish itself, that's when stress fractures occur. So they can either occur because of, overuse on the use end, so to speak, meaning that there's too much damage for even healthy cells to replenish themselves, or an underlying condition such as osteoporosis, which is often typical in normal aging, where the repair process just slows down to the point that normal daily use can't.
So it can be either an overuse,
exactly,
injury, or as a result of aging,
exactly,
your bone replenishment doesn't keep up.
Precisely.
And so then you get, so what are they actually, what are some of the symptoms? Is it similar?
Yeah, in the feet it usually occurs, the most common place is in the metatarsals, which are the, the kind of longer bones. If you compare it to your hand, it would be kind of near the palm of your hand or along the length of the foot. Those bones see quite a bit of shear stress over time. There's certain foot conditions that kind of put extra weight in a typical area, such as a higher arch, tends to put more weight on the outside part of the foot, and so those bones are under more stress than normal. Stress fractures typically present as usually people call it a kind of a gnawing type deep pain initially. It's almost always activity related, meaning, it's with weight bearing, with loading, with prolonged walking, these also can occur in runners, so only when they run. So it starts out as usually just being related to activities. If it then propagates to a complete fracture where you go from, just a kind of a hairline, to use your terminology, situation to something that's actually broken, displaced a little bit, then that tends to be more constant pain.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with orthopedist Dr. Scott Van Valkenburg. We're talking about common problems of the foot and ankle and what to do about them. I don't want to run out of time because I wanted to ask you a couple of other quick questions, but what do you do with a stress fracture? What do you recommend for people?
Sure. So the major treatment is just to, as long as it hasn't propagated to the point that it's a displaced fracture, is to cut back on activities. Oftentimes we do immobilize for a brief period of time in like a walking boot, something to give the bones a rest.
But if you just give them a rest, that's sufficient.
Yeah.
Generally that they will heal on their own.
Generally they do heal on their own.
And rarely require surgery.
Rarely. The only case that they would require surgery, if there's certain bones that are just the downside of if they do propagate to a complete fracture, is so great that we kind of prophylactically treat them with surgery. But a vast majority of them, we 90% at least, we treat non-operatively.
Let me get on to soft tissue injuries, because those are often very common. And there were two in particular I wanted to cover. One is Achilles tendonitis. What exactly is it? When does it happen? What do you do about it?
Sure. Well, that's exactly right. It's very common, more common in people that are very active, either walking, running, that sort of thing. What it is it's an inflammatory condition of the major tendon around the ankle, which is the Achilles tendon, largest tendon in the body. It is the connection between three muscles in your calf down to the back part of your heel, and what it does is helps propel you forward in walking or climbing stairs and that kind of thing.
Does it usually occur as a result of injury?
It usually occurs, probably a vast majority occur as a result of overuse.
So similar in a way to the stress factor.
Exactly. And it's an inflammatory condition, meaning it's something that kind of builds over time rather than a single episode where you
have an
injury.
It's not an acute injury.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what do you do about that? What do you recommend people do to treat it?
Yep. So it's like many other tendinopathies, we call them, or entheseopathies, is we initially treat with, cutting back on the activities that seem to exacerbate it.
So rest.
Rest. Some ice. Anti-inflammatories like Aleve or ibuprofen are important. And then also occasionally a heel lift or some method of allowing the tendon to relax a little bit and take some time, take a slight vacation in order to recover, and then a period of getting into therapy or some stretching sort of exercises to prevent it from recurring.
Yeah. And maybe even changing your habits and
exactly.
How you're doing things.
Activity modification is a big thing in foot and ankle.
What about plantar fasciitis? And again, I don't want to run out of time. We only have about a minute and a half left.
Sure. Yeah, so plantar fasciitis is along the same lines. It's an inflammatory condition. It's actually related to Achilles tendonitis because, they're kind of in proximity to each other. The plantar fascia is a band of tissue that goes between the heel bone all the way to the ball of the foot. It's responsible for helping us maintain our arch, very important for walking. The area where the tissue inserts on the heel bone is particularly prone to this inflammatory condition, and it can be a very frustrating condition because it does take a long time to see improvements in. But a vast majority of them, we do see improved. Over 95% do improve with simple stretching, anti-inflammatory medication, ice, and that sort of thing.
And perhaps taking weight off for a while and.
Yeah, not so much. We tend to treat with something to put in the shoe, like an orthotic. I would not recommend crutches or any. We don't need to. It's not a condition that you need to take a major break from.
But generally, you do see improvement with those kinds of treatments.
Yeah, usually it can take 6 months, even a year sometimes, but generally
Wow.
We do see improvement.
Well, I want to thank you. This is a good broad overview of the kinds of things that people do face. And as you said, they're very common. And I think people often don't know exactly what to do when.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, what you're saying is, especially in the soft tissue injuries, dialing back the kind of activity that you're doing for a period of time and dealing with the inflammatory process with ice and ibuprofen, anti-inflammatories, is generally the best way to go.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Scott Van Valkenburg. He's an orthopedic surgeon. He's the assistant professor of orthopedic surgery and the division chief of orthopedic foot and ankle surgery at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Excuses, or data, facts, evidence. Well, folks, even though I'm a psychologist who deals in happier, healthier, successier, we're going to have a physics lesson today. That's right. Sir Isaac Newton's first law of motion states, a body at rest will remain at rest unless an outside force acts on it. Now, the fact is our 21st century culture has systematically engineered all, quote, unnecessary motion out of our lives. As a result, a lot of us have bodies that are at rest almost all the time, and so much resting is getting us to the big rest, i.e. rest in peace, quicker and quicker. Now, we all know this. How come we're not doing something different? Well, because of Sir Rich O'Neill's first law of mental motion, i.e. a brain at rest tends to stay at rest unless acted on by an outside force. That is, unless a danger is immediate, our brains generate reasons, i.e. excuses, to do same old, i.e. as little as possible. For example, even though we know too much resting is killing us, a lot of us think, I've been sitting here for so long, there is no hope for me to get in shape any longer. And we stay put. So, how do we get our brains thinking differently so we can do something diff, i.e. get moving? Well, remember that outside force? The antidote to irrational excuses is an outside force of data, facts, evidence. Don't look now, but here they come. New research shows a doable, consistent, gradually increasing exercise program transformed roughly 30-year-old sit-around-all-the-time Janes and Joes into people with hearts like elite athletes, that's right, who accomplish dramatic exercise goals in a single year. They started off with 30 to 45 minutes of easy moving 3 to 4 times a week. You can do that. Brisk walking, jogging, bicycling, swimming. As they got fitter and had more energy, you'd like that, wouldn't you? They did more and increased the intensity to include intervals of hard exercise with rest periods. It's not too bad. Years end, not only did these folks have amazing hearts, but 10 of the 12 ran a marathon. One rode 100 miles on a bike, and the 12th did an Olympic distance triathlon. Now, what if your brain is saying, but they were so much younger than me? Me too. Another study from about a year ago showed that just 6 months of regular walking, jogging, or biking, quote, restored the same level of aerobic capacity, end quote, that those 50-ish folks had 30 years earlier at 20. Imagine that. Want more good news? Sir Isaac Newton also says, a body in motion will remain in motion unless acted upon by an outside force. Sir Rich O'Neill's translation, once you get going, you'll keep on keeping on. I'm Dr. Rich. Do the diff, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, hot flashes, hormones, and heart disease. What's the connection? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of March 1st. Make the extra mile worthwhile. It's time for a healthy exercise routine tip. As you increase time, duration, or switch up exercise activities, you should reward yourself for your progress. Keep a journal tracking these smaller milestones so you can see how far you've come and get motivated for the next step. Little incentives like new workout gear, books, movies, or smartphone apps can make fitness fun and push you to go further. Take a look at your past fitness goals this week and set your next one. Figure out a reward that you can aim for and contemplate what you will need to achieve success. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Hot flashes, well, they can be the bane of menopausal women.
But if you are one of them and are taking or considering taking hormone replacement therapy to treat them, you may want to consider the potential risks to your heart and whether hormone therapy is right for you. Here with more on this is Dr. Shaki Badaway, Professor and Director of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Badaway. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So hormone replacement therapy has been used to treat the symptoms of menopause, like hot flashes. Tell us about how that all came about.
Well, hot flashes are affecting probably about 80% of menopausal women. And it leads to lack of sleep. People wake up at night with night sweats. It leads to emotional problems. The woman cannot do things that she used to do freely, go out and so on. She's concerned about these hot flashes interfering with her social activity. So it is a problem. For many, many years or many decades, hormone therapy has been the ideal treatment for hot flashes. And still, it could be used safely if you use it in the proper situations.
But what was the thinking with regard to heart disease with hormone therapy? Was it thought to be a benefit to heart disease, helping people with heart disease issues, or was it thought to perhaps cause problems?
Well, there are different studies. There are what we call observational studies, means you give hormone therapy and you find these people are improving and so on. You say, well, it is good and it is not causing any heart problems. But the well-controlled studies, especially the Women Health Initiative studies, gave us another dimension. For example, when they tried hormone therapy, they found that there is slight increase in coronary artery disease, a slight increase in breast cancer. However, when they tried estrogen alone, without the progestin, there was no heart problems, there was no breast problems.
Would the estrogen alone help with hot flashes?
Absolutely.
Ah.
And a woman who has no uterus can take estrogen alone, and that will be fine. However, we have to define who is the person or the woman that is fit to take hormone therapy. So we have to see the contraindications to that or the risk factors. Hypertension, diabetes, smoking, lack of exercise, increase in weight, all these are risk factors, and we should not give a woman hormone therapy. She should take a non-hormonal treatment until all these factors are treated and corrected.
So basically, hormone therapy is going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Correct.
You're going to have to look at the person's history, look at their family history perhaps, and the whole situation, and even if they're suffering from hot flashes, if there are any of these underlying potential cardiac risk factors, you would not necessarily use hormone therapy.
Absolutely. There are other therapies that we could use, and the American College of OBGYN gave us other alternatives to use, like, for example, non-hormonal treatment like the SSRIs. These are very good. They are as effective as hormonal therapy in alleviating the hot flashes. Exercise. Also, some people use soy preparations, and they are happy with that, and it alleviates hot flashes. So they could do that.
There's been some controversy around soy, though. I think if you use too much, there was some concern that it was causing more problems than... I think part of the problem for women these days is this is still such an unexplored or unknown area. In your practice, do you feel that you can comfortably guide women through this process in terms of who should take hormone therapy?
Yes, absolutely. We sit down and we take history, first of all, and we take notice about any predisposing factors for coronary artery disease or for this or that, and we see who is fit to take the hormone. And if somebody is fit to take the hormone therapy, we should use the lowest possible dose to avoid many of the side effects with high doses. Studies have shown that the lowest dose is as effective in alleviating hot flashes at the high dose without all these complications of the high dose.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with OBGYN Dr. Shaki Badaway. We're talking about hormone therapy and heart disease. So why do the hormones cause heart disease? I mean, is it something that it's doing to the vasculature in the body?
It's the predisposing factors that lead to the heart disease. It is not the hormone.
I see.
And I'll tell you why. Studies have been done on estrogen alone, and they evaluated the lipids, the cholesterol, the triglycerides, the HDL and LDL. Guess what? Estrogen was found to lower the total cholesterol, to lower the LDL, to increase the HDL. And these are all protective. Keep the arteries open. So there are good things about estrogen, but you have to use the small dose, and you have to use it in a person who is not predisposed. For example, hypercholesterolemia has to be treated first. It's one of the predisposing factors.
How about people who have a tendency toward clotting, or there's some concern about maybe they have a family
history?
They should not take
hormone therapy.
Because that enhances
exactly.
the clotting mechanism.
Exactly.
And they can be more apt to have a stroke of some kind.
Exactly. So history of blood clots and factors like factor 5, Leiden, for example, or
which is a clotting disorder.
Clotting disorder. So these people should not touch hormone therapy.
So in your experience now these days, what's happening with women in terms of, in your practice, what are you seeing happening in terms of their ability to embrace hormone therapy or their reluctance to use it? I mean, with all of the hype about breast cancer, increase in breast cancer, and now potential increase in heart disease, has it gone the way? I mean, has it kind of gone away, or are people still embracing it?
I think I'm very pleased to see that women read all these studies and come to the office and discuss it. And some of them are understanding, and they don't have any predisposing factors, and they say, well, I will try it. I will try a small dose. Others say, no, I don't want to take it, although I am free of any predisposing factors, but I want non-hormonal treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And we are glad to help. It's after all, it's the patient and the doctor. Together, they have to work a program that's acceptable to the patient.
And it is a case-by-case basis,
exactly,
as you said.
Exactly.
So these non-hormonal therapies are basically some SSRIs, soy, as you mentioned, exercise, that kind
right.
of thing. How effective are they in your experience?
For example, recently the FDA approved one of the non-hormonal treatment for the last year or so, and several of the patients that used it, they are very happy, very satisfied. It really alleviated the hot flashes.
Wow.
So it is as effective.
Wow. Well, that's very hopeful news. And thank you so much for clarifying this, because I think many people, many women out there, are very confused when they hear about hormonal therapy these days, especially with the potential for either heart disease and or breast cancer increase. So I think you've clarified it very well. And clearly, the underlying message is talk to your doctor, go over your history,
absolutely.
Know who you are and what your issues are,
absolutely.
And go from there. Thank you so very much. My guest has been Dr. Shaki Badaway, Professor and Director of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Philip Berry is a physician with the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. He writes a weekly blog on medical ethics, patient-doctor communication, and end-of-life care. He's a novelist as well as a poet. His poem, Breathless, manages to convey how a difficult diagnosis impacts both the patient and a caring physician. Here is Breathless. Knee to knee, skirting the desk, ignore its careless props. The air between us is heavy. The words I choose will change your life. Calm and clear, I am careful. They pass into your mind, solidify, take form and meaning. I watch your mouth slacken. You can no longer see me clearly. Your world is collapsing. My lips continue to move, pale automaton. The space we share has a pacified, early grief rising from a black fire, cold flames drawn to moist skin, consuming the future. The air is thin now. We are both breathless.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn about a new drug to fight HIV/AIDS. Plus, we examine miscarriages, how and when they happened, and a reality check. What's the best healthy weight for you? If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.